of Jeter versus Sam's Club. May we please have appearances of counsel?
May it please the court, John Gagnon of the Law Offices of Rab Hamill, PA, on behalf of the plaintiff, Elise Jeter. Good afternoon, justices.
Good afternoon, Floyd G. Cottrell, on behalf of the defendant, Sam's Club.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Michael Epstein from the Epstein Law Firm on behalf of Amicus Curiae, New Jersey Association of Justice.
Good afternoon. Betsy Ramos of Capehart and Scatcherd on behalf of Amicus Curiae, New Jersey Food Council.
Good afternoon, counsel, and welcome. And as you can tell from the fact that we're starting this argument slated for 1 o'clock at this hour, we're running a little long, and I'm going to encourage parties, especially those with repetitive arguments, to feel comfortable adopting that which has already been presented when it comes your time to speak. We'll start with Mr. Gagnon. Please, go ahead.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I want to thank you for, first of all, granting my petition for certification in this case. It's an honor to be able to argue before this court, especially in regards to such an important, timely issue as the mode of operation doctrine. And I'll get to why I think that is a timely doctrine in a little bit. So the mode of operation, that's the central issue in this case, the applicability and the continued viability of that doctrine. And I would say that in my limited experience in that field and in a little over a decade of premise liability and personal injury experience, there's probably no other rule or doctrine that seems to be more misunderstood and misapplied by both litigants on both sides, plaintiffs and defense attorneys, and also, unfortunately, sometimes by judges, which I would respectfully submit is what happened in this case. The doctrine, the mode of operation doctrine, was first recognized in this state over 60 years ago in Torta v. Grand Union Company, an appellate division case from 1959. And then shortly thereafter, about 5 years later, in Baza v. Vornado, Inc., in 1964 by this court, and then revisited just 2 years after that in the Wallerman case that we all know about. The doctrine is based on considerations of public policy and fairness. And it's essentially just a recognition that a proprietor, this is a quote from Baza, a proprietor's duty to his invitee is one of due care under all the circumstances. Quote, the requirement of actual or constructive knowledge is merely a means of applying the general rule. And the court in that case expressly stated in adopting the mode of operation rule that it felt that the concept of actual and constructive notice has or had been given undue emphasis in its decisions. And essentially what the rule holds is that when a proprietor engages in a way of doing business, i.e. a mode of operation, that carries with it an increased likelihood that a dangerous condition will arise, either by negligence of other customers or by negligence of its own employees, then it relieves the burden of the obligation to prove actual or constructive notice of the specific dangerous condition that caused the plaintiff's incident, and merely shifts that burden or shifts the burden to the defense to show that it took all reasonable measures to ensure a safe premise for its customers. It's important to keep in mind, I think, things that the doctrine does not impose or that are not part of the doctrine. The rule does not impose strict liability. It does not make proprietors insurers. It's a permissive doctrine. And when it's established that the doctrine could apply and thus the instruction should be given to the jury, it's still a question of fact for the jury or fact finder to determine whether the doctrine applies. It's phrased in permissive language. The fact finder could very easily find that the doctrine does not apply. It does not find that there's a mode of operation that creates an increased likelihood of a dangerous condition. And even when the fact finder determines that it does apply, again, it's not a doctrine of a strict liability. It merely shifts the burden to the defense to show that they essentially discharge the duty that they had to begin with, which is to take reasonable measures to provide a reasonably safe premise. And you know, obviously the keywords are reasonable. There's a lot of room for argument in there. it's not a matter of strict liability as defense attorneys like to argue. Now, since the Baza and Wallerman duo, this court has revisited the doctrine in Nisavochia v. Glass Gardens in 2003. And then most recently in the Prialu, I believe that's how it's pronounced, Prialu versus Kentucky Fried Chicken case in 2015, which at this point is over 6 years ago. And in that case, the court outlined the four essential principles of the doctrine. Number one, it has to be a self-service activity. The court was very clear that it's never been extended beyond a self-service activity where customers, independently or with the assistance of employees, it says, may come into direct contact with product displays, shelving, packaging, other aspects of the facility that may present a risk. Number two, the doctrine is limited to application in those areas that are affected by that self-service activity. And the court was very clear in that case to specify that it may extend beyond the produce aisle of supermarkets and other facilities traditionally associated with self-service activities. The court in the Prialu analysis, as part of that second principle, emphasized that there has to be a nexus between the self-service activity and the area and the ultimate harm that the outcome, whatever caused the plaintiff's injuries.
Mr. Gagnon, we're familiar with the basic principles underlying the doctrine itself. And I wanted to get closer to why you believe the appellate division decision in this case was wrong. But before we get there, let me ask you more broadly this, because we're dealing with the sale of grapes in a particular fashion here. Does the mode of operation doctrine, as you understand it, apply to any retail store that sells grapes to the public?
Well, my understanding, Justice, I think that would be a broad statement. I think that really it depends on the facts of the case.
When would it not apply?
That it would not apply to grapes? If you had a situation, where the testimony established that there was no regular conduct of customers opening the grapes to sample them in the store, that would probably preclude the mode of operation charge. That's not what we have in this case, because the defense witness expressly testified that they're aware that customers do this. He guaranteed it happened. He agreed with me that it was not uncommon. He did say, well, the store frowns upon it. And that sounds nice to say that, but the reality is they knew that it was happening on some sort of regular basis, enough that he agreed that it wasn't uncommon.
So I would imagine that virtually every retail store, if they were being candid with you, would say that customers sample grapes every now and again. Given that, when would the doctrine not apply? Are there any other limiting principles that you believe would limit the doctrine as to the retail sale of grapes?
Sure, sticking just with the retail sale of grapes, I think the key word you said there, if they were being candid, it probably would apply to most stores that sell grapes, because stores must know that people are not going to buy grapes if they can't see them, and if they can't, when they want to at least, taste them, because I certainly have bought a lot of grapes in my lifetime. They sometimes look great, but sometimes they taste great, sometimes they don't taste so great.
Taping, sealing, putting up signs, taking precautionary measures of that nature would not preclude the application of the doctrine. I appreciate your candor, but that's what it sounds like you're suggesting to us.
Well, I think it would depend on what the facts showed in terms of what was happening. They could take certain measures. If customers are regularly disregarding those measures, then it's still something they have to take into account.
They could treat it like Staples treats printer ink and puts them behind some sort of plastic locked cabinet that people are not allowed to chew on grapes. I mean, it seems to me that you're saying that unless they take such measures that physically a customer cannot get to the grapes, and I guess once you hand them the grapes in whatever container, they can do what they want with them, but that there has to be an absolute physical bar on a customer doing that. I mean, one would think that when a customer sees a taped container, at least the message is conveyed. We really want you to keep these grapes where they are until you leave our store.
Well, Justice, I think that might be reading a little bit into what that one piece of tape says. That piece of tape could just as easily be there just to prevent them from accidentally popping open, as could happen when you stack a bunch of these plastic containers on top of each other.
I thought that these containers are easily open. They're not taped. They're not taped shut, are they?
They're taped shut.
Was that they had a single piece of tape on each of them, single piece of tape. But the defense witness did agree that they are easily opened and closed.
Right. So you're familiar with Nisovicia, right? So that was dealing with loose bags where grapes could, over the ordinary course, fall out onto the ground, people slip. That was mode of operation. What would be the difference between that and if you were able to prove that people regularly opened up the bags, they tasted them, and the ordinary course they fell on the ground? What's the difference between that and the Nisovicia?
I would respectfully submit that there is no difference. That's exactly, and that was the testimony here, that they knew that customers were regularly, or it wasn't uncommon for them to open them.
That's what you wanted to go to the jury, because at least you had in the deposition what store manager saying wasn't uncommon for people to be opening the bags and tasting the grapes. In fact, he said he'd guarantee that people did it.
Yeah, yes, Justice. And that should go to the, and then that is enough of a factual basis that a charge should be given to the jury and should be up to the fact.
But there is a distinction, is there not? Because what was going on with the grapes in Nisovicia, and I'm sure I'm mangling that name, is that the produce was just all out in an area where people could go up, and that it was up to the customers to take the produce, put it into the bags that they wanted, and the case is very clear. That's where the danger was coming in, because you're asking non-professionals, non-employees to handle produce, which has a way of falling apart here. And it's that action that was the focus of the court here. In this case, what the customer is getting is a sealed container. Yes, it can be pulled open if a customer wants to start eating the grapes before they paid for them or sample them, whatever. Yes, they can be pulled open, but they're getting a sealed container. There's no suggestion in their way they're doing business that we expect the consumer to go up and pick out their grapes and pack the grapes, as was in the other case. So to say there's no distinction, respectfully, seems to gloss over a pretty big distinction. That is that the customer's act was what was creating which was necessary. The customer can't get the grapes any other way. Was creating the danger there.
Well, Justice, I agree that the facts are different. The cases are not identical, but what is the same is that the defendant has a mode of operation that it knows people are opening. It knows it's creating a risk. It's selling these in clamshell containers. Yet the defendant representative admitted in the 104 hearing that and he guaranteed it was happening.
So what's the distinction between that situation and go to several aisles away in Sam's Club and go to the Barbie doll aisle and a child could pull a Barbie doll out of the package and leave it on the ground and somebody could trip over it? You could have consumers unauthorized yanking things out of packaging in the store all day. But you're not suggesting to a consumer, in order to buy this product, you've got to actually handle it and put it in packaging. So it seems to me that there really are very few products in Sam's Club, to use that example, that would not be subject to the mode of operation if you were to prevail in this case.
Well, again, Justice, I think that it comes down to what the facts show and not just hypotheticals like the appellate division used with a cookie hypothetical, or to use your hypothetical, a Barbie doll. If you had a store where the representative admitted that yes, it's not uncommon for children to tear open the Barbie packages and leave them strewn all about the aisle, I would say that probably the mode of operation should apply in that case. That probably should shift the burden to show that the store is doing something about that. I don't think that it's very likely that that situation would ever happen. Just like I don't think it's very likely, like the appellate division said, that, oh, well, the cookies are the same thing. Well, I mean, it depends on what kind of cookies you have. I don't see people opening boxes of Oreos in the store, walking around, eating them, handing them.
It all depends on the circumstances. In this Nisovich, I'm just quoting, we said, business, and I'm quoting, business owners owe to invitees a duty of reasonable or due care to provide a safe environment for doing that, which is within the scope of the invitation. And that's walking safely. And if a supermarket knows that it's a matter of custom, people are opening these bags and grapes are regularly falling on the ground, the store owner is in a better position to protect the invitee than the invitee who's not going to know about the danger. Am I right?
Yes, Justice. And that gets to exactly why I think that this doctrine is so crucially important nowadays. Even just since 2015, when this court last addressed the mode of operation doctrine, because the mode of operation doctrine is all a product of self-service and, you know, the store having customers do things to save expenses rather than doing it itself. As the amicus brief very interestingly pointed out 130 years ago, you go to a supermarket, the clerk would package everything for you and hand it to you. That is not a viable.
You're saying it is when the consumer can pick up a sealed package with a tape on it, which has been put into the package by the store, that there's labor being saved here that should impose a higher duty on the store?
No, I'm just referencing, Justice, the historical fact that the rise that was pointed out in the amicus brief, not my brief, but that the rise in self-service supermarkets around the turn of the last century. Before that, customers would, the clerks would just apparently package all of their produce, including, I guess, grapes, and hand them to them. I'm not, obviously there is a saving factor, an economic factor in the self-service nature of every store nowadays.
Did they put a sign up? Do we know whether or not the supermarket put a sign up near the produce? Do not open up the packages of the grapes. Do we know whether or not they did that?
We don't know that, Justice. I don't think that they did. There has been no evidence that they did.
So that would, and we know they had surveillance. They do have surveillance cameras.
They do have surveillance. And all of these points are getting to why this is so important, because we're in an age of where it's easier than ever for the defendants to bear this minor burden of showing that they discharge this duty that they're supposed to have all along anyway, just by showing that they did a round of the store every hour or so, or whatever that level of reasonableness is. It's not hard for them to show that nowadays. And yet simultaneously, automation and self-service has jumped to the next level. Even 5-6 years ago, I don't know, I can't remember when this self-checkout started, but now self-checkout seems to be more the norm than it was before.
And Mr. Gannon, I have a question, a procedural question. As I understand it, this court granted certification on this issue because you believe that this is something that should have been determined by the jury. And I want to just get these procedural facts clear. This was an in limine motion on the day of trial brought by the defendant to ask in the trial court to prevent you from charging the jury with mode of operation. Am I correct?
You are correct, Justice.
Judge. The court, sua sponte, decided to conduct a 104 hearing and to take testimony on the matter. Am I correct?
Yes, Judge. I argued that it was premature, and the solution for them was to hold a 104.
Not only that, did anybody give you prior notice that this was going to turn into an outcome determination by the trial court?
No, Your Honor. I will say that
summary judgment motion. It was the judge made findings, and he dismissed your case as a matter of law.
Essentially, yes. Although the motion had been filed, I believe, a couple of months before that for a prior trial date, but the motion was never heard or even fully briefed. until
the same trial. Did the defendant ask for a other than to prevent you from to instruct the jury on motor operation? Did they ask for any other relief?
Well, there were other elements that are not part of this certification with regards to barring the plaintiff's treating chiropractor from testifying.
Well, that's another issue. The chiropractor is another issue. I'm talking about were you put on notice that this was going to be akin to a summary judgment motion, that the judge is going to determine not only that the mode of operation was not relevant or appropriate in this case, but that you had no case as a matter of law to get to a jury. Did you know that beforehand?
No, Your Honor, because I also argued that there was an element of constructive notice given the length of time that the surveillance video shows that there had been no rounds or no anything to ensure that there was a safe premise. And the
defendant's witness in that 104 hearing was done telephonically.
Yes, Your Honor.
And your client appeared in court to testify about how the accident happened.
Yes, Your Honor.
So there was the judge made findings of fact based on testimonial evidence over the phone by the defendant and your client, just two witnesses, and determined as a matter of law that the case should be dismissed. No one submitted briefs on our motion.
I believe they submitted a brief when they filed their motion. My office never formally opposed the motion. Did not submit.
Your understanding of the motion was that it was going to be dealing with the charge, what the jury should be instructed on, not a summary judgment motion.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And ordinarily, those kinds of charges are done at the charge conference when the evidence is all in before the jury to determine whether there is or is not a rational basis for that. Am I correct?
That is, in my experience, that is correct, Your Honor. That way, it wouldn't have been premature at that point. That is why I was arguing that it was premature. And the court's solution was to hold a telephonic hearing with the defendant's representative.
All right, thank you. That's all I have.
Did you object to the telephonic hearing? And did you ask for additional relief?
I did not, Your Honor.
I want to come back to the doctrine itself. It's a limited exception to the traditional rule. And here we have an employer who did take steps by sealing the clamshell packages to prevent them from being opened. If you were counsel to a retail store, what advice would you give them as you understand the doctrine to limit its scope?
What additional steps could they take such that it didn't apply in all cases?
Well, Justice,
I'm referring to the sale of grapes when I ask that question. Please.
Just keeping it to the sale of grapes. If they truly did not want customers, if they really wanted to preclude customers from opening the grapes to taste them in the store, signs would be one thing they could explore. More packaging or something to prevent it other than a single piece of tape to prevent this easily opened and closed clamshell container from being opened. If it's something that they really wanted to prevent, I would respectfully submit it's probably not that hard. People, you know, once you make it rise that barrier a little bit, that and then people are going to stop doing it.
What would raise it a little bit? What would make it not a little harder that would be available to the store?
Well,
we probably, but what could be done?
We can all think of packaging if they had a little vacuum sealed plastic thing around that wasn't easy to just pop off. It wouldn't be hard to do. It would keep.
Is that available? Is that type of packaging available?
Well, I've seen it on other things, Justice. I'm not a packaging expert. But
have you ever seen a sign in a store saying "Don't eat the produce before you get out of the building"? Ever? Anywhere?
I don't think I have, Justice. No.
No. So what you're saying is that in order to guard against this, I guess if you say it for grapes, you got to say it for mayonnaise, and you got to say it for all the other food items in the entire store, that somebody, an adult, might decide the time to eat the food is while I'm still here in the grocery aisle. I think you're introducing a concept that is just not in grocery retail in New Jersey, that at least that I'm aware of putting up signs saying you got to wait till you get home before you start eating the stuff.
Well, Justice, I was just responding to the Chief Justice's question about
what. I understand, but you're saying what should be done. Question was what should be done.
Sure.
And what you're saying is a sign has to be put up saying, don't eat, these are grapes. You got to pay for them first and get them home, and then you can eat them.
I'm not saying that should be done. And I don't think that that would, I don't think that that's going to stop people from opening the taste of grapes. And I think that ultimately, if supermarkets started making it that hard to taste grapes, they'd probably sell a lot less grapes. And
right.
They probably know that allowing customers to taste them in the store benefits them and they sell more grapes. If people can taste the grapes and they see that they taste they're good, they're going to sell more grapes that way. Unfortunately, when you're selling loose little things that people have no qualms about nibbling like that, because we're not talking about a jar of mayonnaise like your example. I mean, if you had some sort of bizarre store where customers were walking around opening jars of mayonnaise and their representative testified, yeah, it's not uncommon for people to open jars of mayonnaise in the store and it gets on the floor. I would say, as crazy as that sound, I would say that the mode of operation doctrine should probably apply in that case too. Now that sounds ridiculous because it is ridiculous.
But your position is if you're profiting from people and you know that they're opening up the bags and you're profiting from them, and you also know that some of these grapes are going to fall on the ground and eventually someone is going to be seriously injured, then you have a certain obligation. You have a reasonable duty of care.
Right.
It may mean a sign. It may mean, I don't know, every half hour, someone just looks down the aisle to see whether or not they're loose grapes so someone doesn't fall on them.
Right.
It's not a big deal.
Exactly. And it may even mean putting them in these clamshell containers with a piece of tape on them. I have been consistent throughout this litigation. What they did, a jury may ultimately find that was reasonable, that was enough to discharge their duty to do everything that a reasonable proprietor would do to address this risk. But that's a question for the jury, not for the trial judge to decide before the evidence is even put forth. They may find that a piece of tape is reasonable. They might find that a sign is reasonable. They might not, but that is a question for the jury.
What the court did here, and the appellate division agreed, is to find that the mode of operation, which has been said over and over, is a narrow doctrine that only applies under limited circumstances, that changes the burden, puts a burden on a defendant that does not otherwise exist in a situation where the plaintiff generally has all the burdens. The court said, as a matter of law, this doctrine does not apply. And so you know, you're saying it all should go to the jury, but this is an issue of burdens of persuasion and burdens of proof that courts do on clear records decide on all the time. There's no mode of operation case in New Jersey that says you got to send it to the jury. Yes, if there's a factual dispute you would send it to the jury, but courts all the time are called upon to, as a matter of law, decide whether this narrow doctrine that alleviates the burden on the plaintiff and imposes a burden on the defendant should apply. That's what happened here. And so to say it all should go to the jury in every case is inconsistent with what the law's been on this doctrine.
Justice, I never said, and I would never say, that it should go to the jury in every case. The case that I'm aware of, and I'm sure that maybe I have missed cases, but the only case I know that talks about when, or the standard for submitting a factually based charge to the jury in a civil case, is the Costco case, the Walker v. Costco case, which was the mode of operation charge in that case involved. I think there was some evidence of samples of cheesecake being handed out. And the court said, but a very respected judge of the appellate division wrote a very excellent opinion. And it states in there, when there's a factually grounded charge, if there's a reasonable basis for giving the charge, it should be given to the jury. And maybe this is an issue that the court would consider clarifying, that standard.
We have a charge to the jury. And when you look at it, I'm looking at the model jury charge. Is the defendant's business self-service? This is self-service. That meets number one. The second is, Did the accident occur in the affected area of self-service? Two, the only issue is really number three, whether there's a factual nexus between the defendant's self-service activity and the dangerous condition alleged producing the plaintiff's injury. That's what this case is all about. Am I mistaken?
No, Justice, that is exactly what this case is about. And the nexus, I would submit there's clearly a nexus between sale of grapes in containers that the store knows customers, it's not uncommon for them to open them to sample the grapes in the store. And then the plaintiff slips on a grape when she's halfway past, she's in the main grocery aisle where the grapes are sold. Like there, I can't imagine more of a nexus. All this argument about the piece of tape in this clamshell containers and my argument to the trial court and appellate division was essentially that's a question of fact, whether or not that should go to the jury in terms of determining whether or not the defendant did all it could to take reasonable measures to address this risk. They put a piece of tape on it. They put them in clamshell containers. That's great. A jury might agree that that is sufficient to discharge the duty when you're selling grapes and you know that customers are regularly opening them in the store to sample them. But the question, if you just like Justice Albin, like you said, if you just walk through the three elements in the charge, which are basically distilled from the court's opinion in Prialu.
Counsel, under your analysis?
1 through 3.
Every slip and fall case in a grocery store, for example, would always go to the jury whether the mode of operation charge should be given or not, because you're saying the jury could find that it was reasonable or unreasonable. That's the gatekeeper's function. That's the judge's function based on the facts to make that ruling under 104 whether that will be charged or not. Under your analysis, every single case, no matter what, would go to the jury for the jury to decide whether the efforts were reasonable or not.
Justice, that is not what I'm arguing. I'm not certainly not arguing that it should go to the jury in every case. I'm arguing that it should go to the jury when there is a reasonable factual basis in the evidence that could, by a reasonable fact finder, support a conclusion that the doctrine applies. It sounds to me like essentially a summary judgment standard. If there's an evidentiary basis that a reasonable fact finder could conclude that the doctrine applied, then the charge should go to the jury. If not, and courts, it's the same gatekeeping function that trial courts hold with regards to motions for summary judgment. If there's no factual basis for it.
So, contrary to your answer to Judge Fuente's question, you're not arguing with the method. You're arguing that the judge should have found that it should go to the jury. You're not arguing that it was improper for the judge to have one or four hearing. You're just arguing that you're arguing with the judge's ruling or findings of fact.
No, I didn't.
Not with the process.
I didn't argue at the trial level that I didn't object to the Rule 104 hearing. I did argue that it was premature, but at that the trial court was going forward with it. So other than arguing that it was premature.
Going back to the jury question, if the trial had gone forward and at the conclusion of the presentation of the evidence, the defendant moves to not to charge the jury with the mode of operation, would that mean that you would dismiss the case that moment, or you still can prove it in negligence since you have an acknowledgement by the defendant that they were aware that customers ordinarily do this, that they were aware that people have dropped grapes there before? They had taken no steps to, as Justice Albin noted, to perhaps patrol the, or have every now and then go to check out the floor to make sure there's nothing that could be dangerous to the public. So even if you don't have the motor operation rule, and they concede that they were aware of these things happening, so you have enough evidence for notice, enough evidence to perhaps establish negligence. So the only thing the mode of operation rule does is alleviate you of certain, makes it easier to prove your case, but it doesn't mean your case would be completely dismissed based on a lack of a mode of operation rule. It happens all the time. It's just a standard, an ordinary negligence standard. Wouldn't that be true?
That is true, Judge, absolutely. And I argued that, it's in the very end of the transcript of the hearing, I argued that there was also a basis for constructive notice based on the amount of time that shown, which I was indicating to the time of the video, which shows there's clearly no, they didn't do anything to do a survey of the store or an inspection of the premise at all. And that, so I obviously I would have fallen back on that at that point. I do believe that this is strongly that this is clearly a mode of operation case. I really can't imagine a scenario that would call for it more other than where you have the defendant admitting their representative being honest. I give him credit. He was candid. He said, yeah, it's, I guarantee people are doing that in the store. And they, so they know this is happening. So this is not a case where we have people, you know, mayonnaise jars and every single conceivable product. That sort of slippery slope argument, you know, it sounds good, but it's not what I'm arguing for. I'm not arguing that it should apply in every situation.
I'm not saying you are, but the fact is that what is being done as a quote unquote mode of operation, which is handing a consumer a package containing the produce, which has tape on it. The consumer then goes and gets that, is a mode of operation that applies to many, many products in a Sam's Club, a packaged product that a consumer can unravel in the store and throw stuff around or drop it negligently or otherwise, and really has very few limits. When you're talking about a self-service packaging by consumer, which was what was going on in the original grape case in New Jersey, there's some limits to that. But when you're talking about consumers walking up to a shelf in a store like Sam's Club and taking a packaged product out, I respectfully would suggest that this is a very broad reach that goes beyond the parameters of the mode of operation doctrine, at least as it began.
Well, I understand, Justice, what you're saying. I guess, to go back, it depends on the facts of the case. If you had a store where people were opening things on all different aisles, and for some reason the store had this culture of people doing this on some sort of regular basis, and that's what the evidence showed, then I would submit, yeah, the mode of operation should apply, and it should shift the burden, which perhaps this idea that a customer needs to show actual or constructive notice is a little outdated in today's environment where people...
And I think you're being candid. And I think, frankly, you're being candid in saying what you want to get rid of is actual or constructive notice. If there's a history of people dropping stuff in stores, which people do. I mean, I think anybody... I'm going outside the record here, but I think anybody who's spent time in a store like a Sam's Club knows that there's all kinds of stuff that people drop. Kids pull toys out, adults look at something and put it somewhere, there's stuff on the floor. So if that means that as to those broad swaths of products, even if they're packaged, get put into what has been at least to date viewed as a very narrow exception to the normal rules of plaintiff bears the burden of showing actual constructive notice, you are, in fact, I know you're limiting it to your client's cases, well, you should, and you're a very skilled advocate, but you are asking for a very broad expansion of the mode of operation, because that those the grapes here were in a package. And I appreciate your candor talking about it. Maybe what you're saying is that actual and constructive notice should go by the wayside. But I'm glad we're having that conversation because we're not really talking about mode of operation anymore. We're really talking about the premise of all kinds of products being potentially involved.
On that note, Justice, I think it would be helpful to look at what the court said in Baza when it originally adopted or recognize the doctrine in this state, that the actual and constructive notice had undue emphasis had been placed on those requirements, and that this mode of operation, really, they're supposed to just be the way of executing this general rule that a proprietor has a duty of care under all the circumstances.
I'm listening to you. I thought you were arguing for nothing more than what is in our civil jury charge. And it comes down to number 3. And that is whether or not there's a reasonable factual nexus between the defendant's self-service activity and the dangerous condition. And there's a difference between a Barbie doll and grapes that aren't going to be seen, squashed grapes on which people are going to slip and fall and break their hips or other parts of their body, other than other large objects that may rarely fall down or occasionally fall down that people can see.
Justice, that is essentially what I'm arguing. You don't need to expand the doctrine at all to find very easily in this case that it was misapplied below. And that this clearly is a case where the mode of operation charge under just based on the testimony that was adduced at that 104 hearing should go to the jury. I'm just talk about Justice Patterson's point. I'm just saying, if you really want to step back, just look what the court said in Baza. There they were saying that maybe this constructive notice, and because constructive and actual notice, and the court talked about this in that case. Look at it from the perspective of people who go into the store. Who bears the burden? Who is it easier to show that they acted reasonably, that they had someone doing rounds, that they cleaned the floor every hour or 2 hours or whatever is determined to be reasonable, versus someone who's just one of 10,000 people in that store walking in there and boom, they slip on a grape.
Which raises another this interesting issue between what was said in Nisavice and some really conservative use of constructive notice. Business, and this is our language, business owners owe to invitees a duty of reasonable or due care to provide a safe environment for doing that which, and the duty of care, and I'm reading from our decision, the duty of care requires a business owner to discover and eliminate dangerous conditions. That's what we've said.
Yes, Justice. I recall that. I don't know exactly what you're reading from, but
I'm reading from Nisavice. That's what we said.
Yeah, and that's always been our law. That's always been our law, and it's been the plaintiff's burden to prove a violation of the burden of due care. But what mode of operation does is shift that burden. It's not, I'm not in any way, and I don't want to be mistaken for it in any way, suggesting that that there is not a duty of due care on the part of a property owner. Of course there is with a business invitee. But we're talking about a special rule that alleviates the burden on the plaintiff and shifts it to the defendant. And that, there are very few of those rules in civil law. And that's what we're talking about here. We're not talking about somehow abrogating the duty of a property owner to use due care.
Except that you don't even get to that stage unless the plaintiff can prove that they knew about it or that it had been there so long that they should have known about it, when the defense and the proprietors are the ones who have easy access to all sorts, you know, they're the ones for them to prove.
Are you telling us we should get rid of the requirement of actual and constructive notice in a commercial property for business invitees? Is that what you're arguing for?
That's not what I'm arguing for, Justice. No, that's not what I'm arguing for. I'm arguing for an application of the mode of operation doctrine as it's always been in this state. And I would argue easily that Nisavice, Prialu, every case that this court has heard has never really expanded the doctrine. It's only applied it. The doctrine has been the same the whole time. If they have a mode of operation, whatever that be, where they know it's giving rise to an increased chance of harm, a risk, and then they have a duty, then, and it's in the, and there's a nexus and it's in the area, it's not so remote, you know, that it's like outside in the parking lot or whatever, that the burden shifts to them to show that they acted reasonably.
Are there any other questions for Mr. Gagnon?
Anything you'd like to say in summing up your argument?
No, Chief Justice. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Epstein.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court, Chief Justice, Associate Justice, on behalf of NJAJ, I'd like to thank the court for once again allowing the organization to appear as a friend of the court. This case presents a fairly narrow issue involving the mode of operation jury instruction. When all reasonable inferences are provided to Ms. Jeter, should the mode of operation charge be given to the jury when it was undisputed, according to the appellate division, that the sale of grapes was self-service and the area of the accident was in the zone of danger, and the sole issue, as Justice Albin has said, was whether there was a reasonable factual nexus between the self-service and the dangerous condition. Alternatively, as a matter of law, should the charge have not been given to the jury as a matter of law? On behalf of NJJ, we submit that, like Walker, when the facts in this case are viewed in a light most favorable to Ms. Jeter, a reasonable factual basis exists in the evidence to provide the mode of operation charge to the jury. The jury, as the fact finder, should make the ultimate decision of whether defendant was negligent or not. In this case, the trial court and appellate division respectfully overstepped the jury's fact-finding role when they ruled as a matter of law that the mode of operation charge did not apply to this case. In finding that there was no nexus between the dangerous condition of a grape on the floor and the self-service, which is the third element, and the only element at issue in this case, the appellate division narrowly defined mode of operation as selling grapes in clamshells. That is not the issue, as the focus has to be on the self-service. Respectfully, in listening to the prior argument, the self-service is the customer going to the grape stand, taking the clamshell of grapes and removing it. That is self-service. What would not be self-service is if the store had a clerk and took the clamshells himself or herself and put them in a bag in the cart. That would not be self-service, and then there was a checkout. So more importantly, the appellate division's reliance on customer negligence in the sealed clamshells as dispositive was mistaken and ignored this court's decisions and explanations in Baza, Wollerman, Nisavoccia, and Preolu. I submit that the reliance on customer negligence and the piece of tape flipped the shifting burden of whether defendant's actions were reasonable into the element of whether there was a factual nexus between self-service and the dangerous condition. The conversation that was just had with plaintiff's counsel really deals with whether or not the defendant rebuts the inference of negligence and the lack of notice by showing that it was reasonable in the efforts that it took.
Mr. Epstein, focusing on factor three.
Yes, Your Honor.
You can see in each of these cases what the nexus between the self-service are. So Nisavoccia, the customer's doing the packaging, and that's where the mishap occurs. Okay.
May I interrupt you? I don't think that's actually, in Nisavoccia, the grapes came from the manufacturer in a bag, and the bag was placed in the store, and then the customer took the bag and put the bag into the cart, I think.
Right. But the customer's doing the handling, and that's where the falling is taking place. It's a normal customer function of taking a package and putting it in. What we're dealing with here is the only way these grapes escape that packaging, as far as this record is concerned, is because people are opening them despite the tape and eating part of the produce in the store. And that's I suppose that's self-service in a very broad way when you're eating the food before you paid for it, but it's not because the danger does not arise because the customer is simply moving the produce into her cart or his cart. The danger arises because they're doing something else. They're opening it and sampling, apparently, according to the store set. So it seems to me that if that's a nexus, then the nexus applies to virtually every customer pulling everything out potentially in every department of the store.
I don't agree with the premise, Justice. And I don't, because the self-service of taking the clamshell out and then putting in your cart or playing around with it, I think if we just look at four very basic principles from this court's prior decisions, including Your Honor's decision in Preolu. Baza, this court explained that there was a reasonable probability that a dangerous condition would occur from the self-service, then need not prove notice. Wollerman says that this court specifically stated that a patron's carelessness from the self-service is to be anticipated. So in this kitchen, and then you get Nisavoccia, which Mr. Stein argued before this court as a distinguished plaintiff's counsel, said this court said that discussed in depth that foreseeability as to risk of injury from the self-service is critical in deciding whether to charge the jury. And then your honors decision, Justice Patterson and Prelude, your honor wrote, this court made it clear that demonstrable pattern of conduct from self-service could be sufficient to allow for the charge to be given. So demonstrable pattern of conduct. And also, Your Honor emphasized that this is not premises law, but a special application of foreseeability. Mm-hmm. In this case, so we're talking about foreseeability, pattern of conduct, anticipation of customer carelessness. We have all of those things. And here, we're not guessing that those things existed. We're not thinking maybe the defendant actually knew that this was happening.
Mr. Epstein?
Yes, Your Honor.
For purposes of the third factor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do we look simply at the fact that an entity is a self-service market or at the nature of the self-service operation? And the Civicia, as compared to this case, illuminates that difference. In the Civicia, you had open, vented bags of grapes that would reasonably foreseeably permit spillage and putting your hand in and taking a sample and one slipping on the floor. The nature of the operation here was closed, sealed containers. My question again, do we look to the nature of the operation, or is it simply enough to say, well, this is self-service and there's a reasonable nexus?
That's a very good question, Your Honor. I think you have to look to the latter, which is the nature of the self-service, which then removes this issue of the Barbie doll. Here, the nature of the self-service of a clamshell with one piece of tape, clearly easily seen, very easily open, where the store foreseeability, I would say even if the store didn't know, but it was foreseeable that people were opening and tasting and in anticipation of customer carelessness would apply. But here you have more than that, Justice, Chief Justice. You have the store knowing that people and customers are doing this and that grapes are falling on the floor. So the nature of the self-service here of the clamshell with a piece of tape, open, tasting, dropping, falling on the floor, then the factual nexus from the nature of the self-service to the dangerous condition, there was a reasonable factual basis for a jury to make that decision. And then ultimately—
Why does that remove other situations like children's toys where kids are grabbing packages as they're walking by and stuff can fall out? Where is the principal distinction between the grape situation in a closed package with a seal and all of the other products in the store that are in closed packages, but packages that people, adults or children, can open if they choose to do so, which presumably happens in stores all over the place?
Because I think this court has said, when you just think of foreseeability, anticipation of customer carelessness for when this doctrine should apply,
right,
and when it's a probability of a dangerous condition existing, which are all from those three, is very different from your honor's suggestion of a Barbie doll being taken out of a box and left on the floor by a child.
Let me use a better example. A children's toy with small parts. Easy to open the package. It gets dropped. The parents don't even notice the child is dropped part of the toy out there. There's just, you could go through a store and come up with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of examples of packaged products that are not intended to be opened in store, but they do get opened in store for all kinds of reasons by adults and children. And where it, and how do you distinguish between this packaged product with a piece of tape on it and all those other packaged products that a cardboard box can be opened in a split second by anybody, child or adult? Where does it end?
Well, I think we start with the principle. I think we're going a little bit to the left, but that's okay, or to the right, whichever way you want to go. But I think we start with negligence, and we start with that you do need to prove constructive or actual notice when you start the case. And I do think, I want to say to Judge Fuentes' opinion, just questions before, I think the procedure here is troubling.
Please go ahead. Procedure, let's not veer.
I apologize.
Where does it end?
Okay.
With packaged products, maybe grapes, this happens more often. I have no idea, but I certainly have, just in my own experience, have seen all kinds of stuff on the floor of stores in every department.
So
clothing, people look at things, it gets dropped. Every one of those things is a potential hazard. What is it about this product that puts it in the mode of operation that would not extend throughout the store?
Well, I think it goes back to the nature of the self-service, right? Yeah, taking a toy is self-service because you're taking, once a customer is handling a product, it is self-service.
Right.
There's no question that self-service exists in this case and in all of those situations. That's the first element. Fine. The next question is, if you take a Barbie doll or a toy and you drop it six rows away, you could argue that that's not a geographic nexus, and that would remove the charge. The third factor, which is really what we're discussing here, is there a reasonable factual nexus?
Hold on a second. You pull the toy down, you pull the Barbie doll. Let's say it gets dropped right around the place where the kid grabbed it.
Right. So now you're into element three. Now we're into the third element only. Is that nature of the self-service a reasonable factual nexus to the dangerous condition? In that situation, a doll on the floor is, to me, very different in a reasonably factual nexus analysis from a grape, which we
Why?
Know.
Why? What about a small part that you can trip on? I'm not talking about a doll. It was a poor example. Let's leave Barbie out of this. I'm talking about a small part of anything, adult product, children product, whatever it may be.
A model airplane that could be put together.
Right.
With little parts. You open the box. Model airplane, little wheels fall to the ground.
I don't think it's foreseeable that a model airplane box sold in a supermarket would be open where pieces be on the floor.
Doesn't it depend upon, everything depends upon the circumstances. In this particular case, there's evidence in the record of a routine, not once, not twice, but knowledge that this is going on. If there were other circumstances, let's take Legos, where the store owner knew that every particular day, kids were taking the Legos out and leaving them on the floor, and the business owner did nothing about it. It might be the same. It all depends upon the circumstances, the routine, the dangerousness, and that's what our charge talks about. Are you on notice of the dangerousness of grapes falling regularly on the ground? Go ahead.
I agree with you, Justice Albin. I think that's what Judge Sabatino said in Walker. Is there a reasonable factual predicate for the charge? I'm not saying that the plaintiff would win in this case. I have no idea what the jury would do. The jury might ultimately decide that the defendant's rebuttal of the inference and the burden. And I think that the burden, it's not strict liability. It's not a change in the burden of persuasion. It's a mere burden of production for the defense. So all the jury here might have concluded that the plaintiff loses and that Sam's did everything that they should have done. But in this case, we're talking, as Judge Justice Albin, you just articulated what I think Judge Sabatino articulated in the Walker case. Is there a reasonable factual predicate to give the charge? And here we know from a pattern of conduct, which was discussed in the Prelude case, is sufficient to give the charge. And there's a pattern of conduct where you know there's a dangerous condition. That's the difference here. And I think every case depends on the facts. And is there a reasonable factual nexus? And as a matter of law, to say that there's not is really a gross departure, respectfully, from the prior cases of this and decisions of this court. I have to suggest to the court that this, when we talk about principles of foreseeability, which is the last real main discussion on this doctrine from this court, how is this foreseeable use of the clamshell of opening and getting it any different than product liability foreseeable misuse, where product liability applies, the doctrine and the act apply when a product is misused, but it's foreseeable it's going to be misused. Here, it's foreseeable that people are going to remove one piece of tape to use the grapes because we know from the actual evidence that people were doing it on a regular basis.
I don't think strict liability is informative here, respectfully.
It's foreseeability just is the same, Your Honor. Foreseeability doesn't change.
No, I understand, but foreseeability is part of the negligence. But to use the foreseeable misuse doctrine on a product liability when the policy reasons behind imposing on a product manufacturer have long been explained, that goes beyond negligence. Negligence is not the same as strict liability. I just don't think it's
I'm not arguing for strict liability.
That isn't me.
I'm not arguing strict liability. I'm just arguing that the principles of foreseeability, you could even look at attractive nuisance. So, I mean, when you know that people are going to use something that's a nuisance because it's attractive to children, I'm just saying there's analogous doctrines where this court has seen and used foreseeability when people are going to do something they shouldn't do. That's what I was trying to convey.
Mr. Epstein, I don't want to interrupt you. I just want to keep an eye on the clock here. Is there anything else you'd like to add as part of your presentation?
If I may, Chief Justice, I do think that Judge Fuentes' questions with respect to the procedure, this was wrong. This is not how it should have been done. To discuss whether a charge is going to be given before any evidence is heard in a trial is a mistake. There should have been a charge conference when all the evidence was completed, and the determination of whether or not the charge conference, whether or not the charge should have been given, should have been done at the end of the case, not in a motion in limine or a summary judgment where the rules of court have been changed to say that summary judgment motions should not be disguised in a motion in limine. I do think that procedure was incorrect and unfair to the plaintiff in this case. Lastly, Your Honor, that I did want to address, I do want to emphasize that I think a lot of the discussion today and the appellate division's decision really is focused on whether or not the defendant's actions were reasonable, which is the rebuttal of the inference that the plaintiff would get in this case. And there's a lot of factors there that could, was one piece enough? Should it have been three pieces? Should an employee have been on in the area, say, don't open him, don't taste them, just put them in your cart? Should they had a sign? Should they have taken the clamshell out of circulation when someone opened it? Because now you had the risk of danger. There's a lot of arguments the plaintiff could make in response to the defendant's arguments that they acted reasonably. All of those issues are not dispositive as a matter of law for a trial court judge to decide that. And it really should have been for the fact finder. And I thank you for the opportunity to argue today. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Cottrell.
You need to unmute.
Got it. Thank you, Your Honor. The evidence established that the Sam's Club did not sell grapes in bulk, that is, in bins that allowed customers to pick up and inspect the bunches of grapes, and in handling the grapes, potentially allow some to fall to the floor. Sam's Club only sold grapes in transparent plastic clamshell cases with interlocking tabs that would hold them closed, and as an additional measure to keep them closed, a piece of tape. The method of sale allowed customers to see and inspect the grapes because of the transparency, rather than handle the grapes themselves, and therefore prevent any spillage and mitigated the dangers that were found in Nisavecchia. The trial court held a Rule 104 hearing on the issue, whether there was a factual basis to charge the mode of operation. The court determined after hearing testimony and allowing appellant a full opportunity to present evidence that the mode of operation did not apply. Appellant conceded that there was no actual notice. The court rejected the argument of constructive notice and dismissed the case. The issue before the court is whether the mode of operation should apply to the opening of a closed and sealed container and the handling of the merchandise within the store by the customers, contrary to the store's intention. Case law on the mode of operation has always noted that the mode of operation is an exception to the requirement of proof of actual or constructive notice that can fairly be imposed on the retailer choosing to operate its business so as to allow the customers to handle and foreseeably drop unpackaged loose merchandise. Here, Sam's Club did not make that choice, but instead elected to package an easily dropped food item in a container that prevented that spillage. The method of sale was made safer. The rationale for the mode of operation, therefore, does not exist. In Wallerman versus Grand Union, which a brief quote, which is instructive, when greens are sold from open bins on a self-service basis, there is a likelihood that some will fall or be dropped to the floor. If the operator chooses to sell in this way, he must do what is reasonably necessary to protect the customer from the risk of injury that the mode of operation is likely to generate. Similarly, in this Nisavecchia versus Glass Gardens, the grapes were sold in unsealed bags that in which a spillage was foreseeable. These hazards were mitigated by the clamshell container packaging. To date, the mode of operation has never been expanded to encompass packaged goods opened by customers in the store. Such an expansion would place the stores in an impossible position. All packages can be opened, and the stores are powerless to prevent customers so inclined from doing so. An exception would be created that swallows the rule. Everything would be mode of operation. And we close our initial comments by noting that contrary to the dire predictions of the appellates, the store is not completely insulated from liability if the mode of operation is not applied to grapes that fall from customers opening up the clamshell, you know, while in the store. There's still concepts of actual or constructive notice that would apply to potentially allow a recovery. Thank you.
Counsel.
Mr. Cottrell, if I could, Justice. Sure. You're correct that you've made your operation safer than it was in Nosso Voce. But if Sam's Club nonetheless knows that customers are opening containers, whether they're taped or not, what obligation does it have?
Well, certainly the store has to remain vigilant on any type of spillage or debris that's in the store. And the concept of actual or constructive notice would be sufficient to call them account to any sort of droppage of grapes in the store. But the mode of operation, I would suggest, should not apply for a few reasons, if I may. The mode of operations continuously noted the intention of the store in the way it merchandised its goods. Here, Sam's Club did not sell loose grapes. It sold packages of grapes. The customer was not free to open them, take half a bunch, mix and match between the white and the red grapes, or do anything. The customer was only permitted to take the whole package.
So on that point, is intention enough to defeat the application of the charge if you know that your intention is not working?
Yes, it would be, Your Honor, because the actions of the customer are remote from the actual sale, and there's different concepts of negligence that would hold the store responsible. When grapes are marketed in bulk, there's a reasonable probability that some grapes would fall. You know, grapes are usually, you know, pretty tenuously attached to the stems. You pick them up, they detach, they bounce. I think it's been noted in this Vecchia. The customer may not even know that the grape has fell, and therefore the mode of operation was instituted to encourage the stores to take better care.
Counsel, isn't the difference essentially under regular negligence? The plaintiff have to prove notice, actual notice, constructive notice, failure to take steps to correct. If it's mode of operation, then there's none of that. The burden shifts to the defendant at that point. And this right. Is not the difference between the two. The plaintiff can still prove that you had notice of it, that you did nothing about it, and the actual constructive notice, and you failed to take any steps. But they'd have to prove that in order to be successful. And the mode of operation, all that is not necessary. Isn't that the real difference?
Well, absolutely. And concepts of actual constructive notice to drop grapes in parts of the store where the grapes fell through some intervening actions of the customers are more than sufficient to address the.
But counsel, we have said in Wallerman and in other cases that the carelessness of the customer is to be anticipated. That's the whole part of the self-service. I want to go back to the chief's questions. The grape on the floor is a danger, correct?
Correct.
It's going to be dangerous whether or not in this Avicia, it's in open vented bags and it falls out, correct? It's going to be just as dangerous to the customer.
Correct.
As if you know that your customers are routinely opening the bags, chomping on the grapes, and dropping them. It's going to be the same danger. On the floor, people slipping, breaking hips and bones. Am I mistaken?
No, Your Honor, but the difference is, I'm sorry.
No, so my last question, then I want you to run with it. Is there a difference if in this avicii, you know, due to the carelessness of the customer, some grapes are gonna fall, or in this case, you know, through your manager, that regularly the grapes are gonna be opened and the grapes are gonna fall? The same thing. Is there really a difference there when at least according to the plaintiff, you can rebut this, you're not doing anything about it. You're not putting up a sign. You're not having anyone patrol the aisles to ensure the safety of the customers in your store.
The difference between the scenarios, Your Honor, is the reasonable probability of both situations. You know, if you're displaying grapes in bulk or in open bags, there's a reasonable probability that some grapes will detach and escape the notice of the customers during handling and fall to the floor and create a hazard. There's a reasonable probability that in transporting those grapes, those easily detachable grapes in the bags and the carts between the produce department to the cash register, a couple might drop off. There's no such reasonable probability that a customer is going to go into a closed container.
Why not? You have evidence.
If you could just finish his response, Justice Albin.
Go ahead.
Well, because a lot of things have to happen for that grape to get on the floor. And I realize the store manager says it's not uncommon, but there was no evidence about what that frequency or what not uncommon means. It just wasn't developed on the record. But you know, for that grape to fall, you have to have a customer who opens the container in the store, and not every customer does that. You have to have a customer.
The only thing that your adversary is saying, not that he should win, he should go to the jury. The fact that your manager said that it was not uncommon, and this was done at a 104 hearing, should have permitted development before the jury, whether or not this was a common practice that created a common danger to customers. Like, why shouldn't that have gone to the jury?
Because it's not the mode of operation of the store to permit those customers to eat those grapes. In fact, it's contrary to their intention. Now, if there's other concepts of negligence that might address that situation, fine.
You know, in this avicii, it wasn't the intention of the store for the grapes to be falling out of the open vented bags. They didn't want that to happen. This is the Chief Justice's questions about intentionality. It's the question, do you know that the customer is likely to be careless? That's the issue in this avicii, and that is perhaps the jury issue here. No?
Well, no, because this avicii, it was the method of packaging that created that opportunity. You didn't need a careless customer. The grape could be thrown into the bag, you put other merchandise in there, and a grape could detach, you know, without a customer being careless in doing so. It's just the way the product was merchandised that made the handling that created that danger.
I mean, the concept of mode of operation, as I understand it, is the way that the business chooses to do its business, to operate its business. And in the case of the packaging, which saved labor in the Nisavoccia case, that created the danger. And what we're talking about here is the packaging can be opened and interfered with by the customer that creates the danger, but it's not the method of doing business that itself creates the danger. Would you say that's the distinction?
Absolutely. And to the extent that the store manager said that, you know, if a package is open and is not paid for, it's considered tampered with and spoiled and it's retired. You know, the intention was to provide a safe method of handling the grapes in the store and get it to the cashier in that package and sold and out the door.
So I don't see our jury charge. It's saying mode of operation is whether or not something is sealed. I'm looking at the jury charge, and it's talking about, was the business a self-service operation? And a self-service operation is when you're going to the shelf or the shelves and getting the product rather than the product being given to you by the business owner. Am I wrong about that?
No, self-service, undeniably, this is a self-service operation.
Okay.
You heard
Judge Fuentes's comments about the procedure here and the sort of the fast moving events that ended up with a dispositive motion, in essence, being done here. Why was that a proper way to resolve this issue?
Well, first, you know, the trial court was under an obligation to make sure that there was a factual basis for the charge. Which in this instance required a 104 hearing. You know, that's the short answer. You know, the longer answer was
the 104 hearing. I know others have mentioned it, but I'm not all that focused on it. What I think is striking about the procedural history here is that this evolved very quickly from a motion in limine to bar a jury charge to a dispositive order by the court throwing it out. Now, there was a mention earlier, and there is some reference in the record. You had it, I don't know if it was you or prior counsel, but there was a motion for summary judgment that had been filed. Am I correct about that, but correct. Not decided?
Correct.
How did it evolve that summary judgment ended up in effect being granted here?
The issue of the mode of operation was briefed, and there was an accompanying motion in limine. There was a discussion in chambers about the case, and the trial court recognized that this is a threshold issue that has to be resolved. He and the court proposed that 104 hearing. It was expedited, but there was time that were allowed to both counsel to, you know, get their thoughts to prepare for it. In fact, what the record would show was, and I was trial counsel. I did not have my witness available, you know, for jury selection yet. He no longer worked for Sam's. He worked for ShopRite. He was available, but not that day. And I believe the court allowed us from mid morning to afternoon to prepare for that 104.
I understand there was a 104 hearing, and I think that, I mean, that's something that is called upon when there's a factual dispute on a motion in limine. I'm not referring to that, but very quickly things evolved from motion in limine to bar the jury charge to development of a factual record. And here's the step I'm concerned with. You ended up with a disposition of the case. I'm sure it was a very happy day for you. But my point is that last step, what was the procedural foundation on which the court could throw the case out at that stage?
The court, well, once the mode of operation was not found not to be factually supported after the 104 hearing, plaintiff candidly conceded that they do not have actual notice. And there was a discussion whether he had any proof of constructive notice. Ultimately, when counsel couldn't demonstrate either, that led to the dismissal. But
since we're talking about the procedure, I'm having a difficulty understanding why the case didn't go to the jury. Testimony should have been taken, and then there should have been then the judge should have decided after the taking of the testimony, whether or not the plaintiff was entitled to the charge. If the plaintiff was not entitled to the charge and there wasn't sufficient evidence to go to the jury, then a judgment should have been entered for the plaintiff. But this use of the 104 hearing before the trial seems very unusual.
It's never happened to me, I could say that. But the trial court was confronted with this issue about the mode of operation, and he was facing a trial that given that the law was unclear whether the mode of operation could be based on a sealed container, he decided to determine whether that factual predicate for the charge existed.
It prevented the perhaps complete development of the record at trial.
I think both counsel were given a full and fair opportunity to present their evidence.
Aren't 104 hearings used to determine what's admissible, what the jury's going to hear beforehand? And isn't that what happened here? There was a 104 motion. The judge determined that the mode of operation did not apply, and at which point, according to you, and I don't know this, that plaintiff said, I can't prove actual constructive notice, which is why the case was dismissed, because of the plaintiff's concession that they couldn't prove actual constructive notice once the mode of operation charge was denied. I happen to be a presiding judge of civil in Camden for a long time, and every Friday we had dozens of those one type of 104 hearings to bar experts to. It's not an unusual procedure, except the plaintiff in this particular case, according to what you say, and I don't know that for a fact, plaintiff said, well, I can't prove actual constructive notice. And at that point, there was no case.
That's exactly how it was framed, Your Honor. There was no actual notice.
Counsel, I thought you said the plaintiff said no actual notice, but did not concede constructive notice. And that was certainly my understanding. There was never a concession. It was like...
Yes, Your Honor. I was just about to say there was a concession of no actual.
I misunderstood that then. Forget it.
Yeah, there was a claim of constructive notice, but it was based upon a shifting of the burden of proof to the defendant to show that they inspected or didn't inspect, which the trial court rejected. So the issue very quickly became, is there factual support for the mode of operation?
Isn't that what a charge conference is for? Jury should have. That's where you have a charge conference. The whole evidence are in, and you determine whether the charge should be given based on that evidence. And if you believe at the end of the state of the plaintiff's case that he didn't make a prima facie case, then you make a 437-2 motion and dismiss. Isn't that how it's done? That's the procedure that the court set up. That's our court rules. That's how we make the playing field level. Isn't that the case?
Well, I'm sorry, Judge. Absolutely, there's a pretrial conference, but on the other hand, the litigants are entitled to know whether there's a legally sustainable theory being presented and what they're going to confront at the trial.
That's for a summary judgment motion. You had an opportunity. A 104 hearing is to determine the admissibility of evidence. That's not what this hearing was used for. What evidence was being determined, whether this is admissible or that's admissible? The 104 hearing was used to determine whether or not the plaintiff would get a charge. That's not what a 104 hearing is supposed to be about. Am I right about that?
No.
It was an unusual use of the 104 hearing mechanism, but the 104 hearing, could be used to determine a factual issue that's rather to avoid it being litigated.
It was an evidentiary hearing, whether it's called 104 and therefore would be put under the admissibility aspect of it or not. It's an evidentiary hearing to give the court a factual basis on which to make a ruling about the applicability of a jury charge. I respectfully, I don't see anything amiss about that at all in terms of a court holding an evidentiary hearing to find out what the facts are in a situation like this, where there's a motion in limine to bar a fact-based jury charge.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Some juries, sometimes witnesses say very strange things during a trial, that the jury, you cannot ring a bell. And that's why we wait for a charge conference when all the evidence is in. But anyway, I think it made my concerns about that clear.
Mr. Cottrell, is there anything else you'd like to present?
No, Your Honor, thank you.
Other questions from anyone? Ms. Ramos, you have the last word.
Well, that's not often.
Thank you. I know it's been probably a long day. I just want to say, Justice Patterson has probably stolen my thunder of almost all my argument, which is the concern of the potential expansion of this rule. I'm here as amicus curiae for the New Jersey Food Council. It's a trade organization representing 1,400 retail food stores in New Jersey, and they're very concerned about if the mode of operation is applied to the sale of a product that's in a closed, sealed container. Where do we go from here? As Justice Patterson points out, that I know maybe the Barbie wasn't a good example, but there are thousands of products that a customer could open, non-attended, non-invited, and to be opened or consumed in the store. And that would be your next case. If you decide that the mode of operation does apply to a accident that occurred as a result of a customer opening a product that's in a closed clamshell interlocking case that's sealed with tape, that will be your next case. The toy that someone falls on, the little toy, the cookie that someone opens, the potato chip bag, you would be surprised. And respectfully, I think Justice Albin, I want to address specifically some of the questions that you asked about the procedures that a store could take. Signs, again, it's not in the record, obviously, but for example, people husk corn. I'll give you a good example. Another produce, they husk corn. Some of my clients put up signs, don't husk the corn. They still do it. And respectfully, a sign, they ignore the sign. And having someone walk up and down the aisle every half an hour, that wouldn't be enough. That's not already enough under some case law. It's found not to be a reasonable procedure. We would have to have someone stationed by the grape display to make sure that no customers open these closed containers in order to deter that and to make sure none fall on the floor. I think I heard, maybe it was you, Justice Albin, talk about that the store admitted knowledge of grape droppage. I don't actually remember that in the record. I only remember them saying that it wasn't uncommon and that they did know that customers opened it, but it was considered to be tampered with. And I want to follow up on that. One of the underlying premises, it seems, in reviewing all of these cases of this court, as well as the appellate division, as well as many unpublished cases, seems to be that this mode of operation somehow inures to the benefit of the store. In this case, selling grapes in a closed container that's sealed, once it's opened, it's tampered with, as Sam's Club's manager has testified to. They can't sell it anymore. They don't profit by that at all. They cannot sell it Your Honors, I'm sure, could take notice of that, that once something is opened and tampered with, that's not a product that's saleable. It doesn't inure to their benefit, which is why they close it and seal it and tape it shut. But they are taking action. This is not a situation, and I think Justice Patterson said it the best. This is not a situation where the store their mode of operation in this case is to have the customer handle the grapes. They're handling the package the grapes come in. It's no different than any other package in the store that's closed and sealed. And if this mode of operation is considered to be self-service and then falls under this very limited exception of the rule, it essentially opens up the entire store to the mode of operation. And that mode of operation limited exception will now subsume the general premises liability rule that's applicable to every other business owner.
So, Ms. Ramos, tell me what a store should be doing. If, based on the facts over here, it knows that packages are commonly being opened, and let's assume, okay, we don't have a developed record, that in that process, grapes are going to be falling from time to time. And grapes on the floor are dangerous. What obligation does the store have? Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Justice Albin, they have the obligation to keep their store, to have reasonable procedures to keep their store reasonably safe. They're not a guarantor. There's definitely not a guarantor. This is not strict liability, which is, and they know, I think Justice Patterson has mentioned.
Tell me the procedure here. You know, because we have a manager saying it's not uncommon for them to be doing this. So let's assume that regularly, carelessly, grapes are falling on. What should they be doing? Don't tell me generalizations. Tell me specifically.
They should be doing the same thing that they do for all of their products. They have an obligation to have reasonable procedures to inspect, to monitor.
What if they're not doing that commensurate with the danger?
Well, I'm sorry, I just didn't finish. However, what I was about to say is the reason that because they're not a guarantor of the safety of their patrons, that is why there is a burden on the plaintiff to prove either constructive or actual knowledge of whatever the dangerous condition is. Yes, they have a duty to keep reasonable procedures. Having a sign, I would say, would be worthless. They know the signs don't work. The customers will ignore them. They've done it. I guess I gave you the corn example, which I know is not in the record. But what they would have to do, if the only procedure that would do it, which is an unreasonable burden to place on the supermarket, because it's not just going to be grapes, it's going to be anything a customer could open, even though it's not intended to be open, they'd have to have an employee standing by the grapes or choose not to sell them. That would be the only way. If mode of operation applies, that would be what this court would be imposing upon the store. And we would contend that would be a very unreasonable burden, because it won't be just grapes. Your next case will be the next thing that's opened, where they will use this case. The next plaintiff comes along that will use this case to say, well, you know, if it's grapes, they were sold in a closed container. They were sold in a way to deter the customer from ever handling the interior of it. And as the manager said, it was sold in a clear container so they could see how fresh they were.
In terms of the customer in the store, the store controls its environment. The customer is there, and if the customer doesn't see the grape and falls, well, the customer is going to get injured. The store, if it knows, and I'm saying not the occasional dropping of a Bobby doll, okay? But if it knows that it's a common practice for grapes to be eaten and for them to drop, the store is in a position to do something that the customer cannot do for himself or herself. Do you agree?
But Justice Albin, I would agree that the store knows that probably, as Justice Patterson pointed out, that things are dropped all the time throughout the store. The grapes are probably no different than anything else. But if the mode of operation applies to it, Your Honor, respectfully, you will make it different than anything else and have expanded this limited exception to every product that's sold in the store. You cannot protect against a customer who is going to tamper with a package, no different than the toy, the animal crackers, the corn husk, the cookies, the single serve, potato chips that someone decides to open, they're hungry. Amazingly, people will open yogurt and grab a spoon and start eating it. It's not intended to be consumed in the store. I think we mentioned Baza. Baza was a situation where it was intended for people to walk around and consume products. And I did want to mention in Nisavokia, I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing it, one of the things that the court specifically mentioned in that ruling, and to quote, this court held that the mode of operation includes the customer's necessarily handling of goods when checking out and employees handling of goods during checkout and the characteristics of the good themselves and the way in which they are packaged. And the two just final points I want to make is packaging is a big difference here. We're not talking about loosely handled product, that's on the shelf that the store, it's going to, in order to their benefit, to have the customer take it and put it in the plastic bag. We're talking about a pre-packaged, and it's pre-weighed, pre-packaged, closed.
And that really differentiates this from all of, at least this court's prior decisions on the mode of operation. A completely closed package that is pulled off the shelf, like a whole range of other packages, and then is tampered with, to use your term, is a whole different type of situation than all of the other cases dealt with before. Am I right about that?
You're exactly right. That's the point I made in my amici brief, that I couldn't find one case where mode of operation applied to a package that was in a closed, sealed package. I could not find one case. The other thing I just do want to mention, perhaps not a big deal, I know it was kind of glossed over the appellate division, is that this fall happened in the main grocery aisle. I've just heard mention, I keep hearing the appellate division, maybe when someone's saying it, like it's near the produce aisle. I'm sure Sam's Club is huge, halfway between the checkout counter and the produce aisle. I don't believe it's near the produce aisle. That's kind of been glossed over. I didn't find any cases which dealt with where mode of operation was applied, not near the checkout counter and not near the produce aisle. So I just want to mention that when you're talking about a reasonable nexus to the self-service operation, again, I couldn't find any case that applied something dropped there, you know, that was a piece of produce because it wasn't being handled at that point. That's just the last point. Again, it's been somewhat glossed over, but my client, as the representing these 1400 retail food stores, are very concerned about the expansion of this doctrine if it would apply in this new scenario to a product that emanates from a closed sealed container. Thank you. I don't have anything else unless anyone has questions for me.
Thank you, Ms. Ramos. And thank you to all counsel for the very helpful arguments.